Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do some people cope better with hardship and heartbreak than others? Since no life is free of setbacks, it's important that we develop skills to carry us through the rough spots without resorting to destructive behaviors or patterns of thinking. And as my guest today will explain, our early relationships and experiences can have a significant impact on the strategies we use to persevere through hard times and eventually to move beyond traumatic events. Marian Underwood is Ashbel Smith Professor at UT Dallas's School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences. Margaret Owen is director of the Center for Children and Families at UTD. The center holds its annual forum this Thursday, September 22nd, and participants will focus on issues surrounding family resilience. Mary and Margaret, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Start with this. Define resilience for us as you would define it, as opposed to the way we might think of it that's not entirely accurate.
Well, we think of resilience as doing well despite all kinds of risks, all kinds of risks to your well-being. Many children face many kinds of risks, and I hope we talk about some of that today. When you would predict that they're just not going to do well, they're going to fail in school, they're going to be miserable, they're not going to achieve, their well-being will be compromised, lo and behold, there are lots of kids who do well. And so we call those the resilient children.
And so I guess part of this process starts with understanding what makes them different from the kids who almost more predictably have serious problems.
That's right. That's right. That's the focus of, I guess, what we would call resilience researchers. It's really a focus of much of our research in developmental psychology. We want to know what factors help kids do well when you might predict from everything that you see and, you know, what's going on, what they're facing, that they're not going to do well. And if we can understand what factors promote well-being despite risks, then those ought to be the factors that promote well-being.
So when you talk about factors promoting well-being, that's different from saying, well, you were born this way and therefore you deal well with this situation or poorly. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think that resilience rests fundamentally on relationships. A colleague of ours at the University of Minnesota, Ann Mastin, talks about the ordinary magic of human relationships. And I think that is what creates resilience in children, and that is formed primarily in the family environment. A sensitive, responsive parent can foster great resilience, but it doesn't have to be a parent. Classic research on resilience shows what every children needs is one person who will stand up for them and advocate for them no matter what. And that might be a biological parent, it might be a grandparent, it might be a teacher. It is someone who will be sensitive and responsive to what that child needs and stand up to protect that child.
Mm-hmm. Are schools set up to foster resilience?
Oh, in some ways, yes. You look at what a child experiences, and they have teachers. They have teachers who should be and are often very, very important to them. They have coaches. They have special activities with very special relationships. A choral conductor, their coach. They have best friends. All of those, because they are dealing with relationships, those foster resilience if those relationships are good ones, supportive ones, responsive to the child's needs.
So a supportive and helpful relationship for a child, I would imagine, also has to be one that's pretty consistent. So it can't be someone who sort of drops in and out of their lives or is great on this day and really kind of scary on another day.
I think we all know that's good, and I think that we can't do it all the time. Mm-hmm. I think recognizing that for yourself too, and knowing that, I think I made an error there. I just went off on some tangent that probably wasn't helping. Let me come back and repair that. And sometimes the effort to repair something that could be a little broken at the moment, I think that says a lot. That says about that says there's an emotional commitment here and a caring.
Is there a genetic component to this, or something about brain chemistry that makes this easier for some children than others?
You know, there may well be. I think it's important to remember that early environments can influence the brain also. We think of the brain influencing how a child grows up, but a child's early experiences mm-hmm. can influence the brain. And, you know, mm-hmm. early stress causes decreases in neuronal networks and brain size, and those are really dangerous effects, and it's hard to separate those from genetics. So the environment and genetics clearly play a role. Genetics, we can't necessarily change. The environment, we have a chance of shifting.
You know, and it's really hard to tease that apart. I mean, we mm-hmm. all want the simpler answer. But, you know, you pointed out that we often do think of resilience as some special quality in the child. And certainly there are characteristics of children that go along with resilience, like intelligence. The more intelligent child in the situation of extreme poverty, parental job loss, you know, other kinds of risks, is maybe going to find a way better. But we also think that those characteristics, those child characteristics, are also nurtured by strong relationships. Mm-hmm. Another characteristic of children that's been pointed to in the research for a long time associated with resilience is a child who's more sociable. Well, guess what? If the child's more sociable, we don't know, did that come from their early relationships? Is that a temperamental quality that maybe makes that child more attractive, which in turn might engender better relationships? You know, it's hard to pull it apart, but we do often look at those child characteristics, but we think that they are a product of relationships.
What sorts of things, we've talked a little bit about poverty, I would imagine, divorce and strife within the home are risk factors. What kinds of things put children at risk for not doing very well?
Well, an obvious one is child abuse and neglect. Mm-hmm. I mean, the rates of child abuse and neglect are up remarkably in this country.
Because of the economy, or do we know why?
You know, I'm not really sure if we know why. They've been rising for a while, and mm-hmm. the numbers are alarming.
Yeah, it is associated with downturns in the economy, and that is in part something that we're looking at. But it's been there and it's rising, and you know, some of it may be greater detection, greater awareness, but it's a big concern.
Mm-hmm. Are there other risk factors as well?
Well, I mean, just so many children at school are bullied, or they're victims, or they're both. Hate crimes are increasing. Violence between partners is increasing. 29% of women and 22% of men during their lifetimes experience relationship violence.
Hmm. So, you know, we've heard these devastating cases recently of children who were bullied and young people who were bullied and felt the need, in some cases, to take or attempt to take their own lives. What kinds of things might have been built into their lives earlier on that would have given them some more protection from these emotions and these responses?
Well, I'm trying to think of how to say something different from what we've already said.
Yeah.
I think that having someone they can turn to is of course really important. I think perhaps, I mean, if we start thinking about some approaches of intervention with these children, helping them to form better relationships with others, giving them greater ability to understand the needs of others, and being a good friend themselves can in turn help bring about that support.
Is it always evident to parents and teachers and people who care about children that they are in crisis, or do some of them do a pretty good job of sort of hiding this from other people?
I think some are reluctant to share what's going on, and it's really difficult to know what to do about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think at some points in development, children's whole soul can rest on, you know, how their same-age peers think of them. And I think we can help children survive bullying if we help them understand that there are lots of groups in the world and lots of activities and lots of possibilities for ways to connect, that everything doesn't depend on how one group at school treats you. I think parents need to be available. They need to try to understand what's happening at school, ask a lot of open-ended questions. Still, these experiences are very painful, and some children choose not to share them.
So it seems as parents, all of us would love to be able to spare our children any kind of stress or heartache or disappointment. Are there, though, opportunities to try and fail at things and learn from that, as opposed to simply shielding them from anything that might be difficult when they're very young?
I think an important thing to convey to your children is that there are all kinds of ups and downs and that we can survive them. Not necessarily the mantra that this will make you stronger. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I would
Nobody
go
wants
there.
To hear that.
I don't know that I would go there. Right. But maybe the mantra, it will be okay. Mm-hmm. I can help you get through this if you need my help. This sounds corny, but tomorrow's another day. Mm-hmm. Let's try this differently tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. And I have to imagine there's some modeling of all of those ideas that can be really helpful as well.
Yeah. I tell it to myself every day.
What is the role of optimism, I guess realistic optimism, as opposed to, you know, ignoring one's problems, the role of thinking this probably will get better, and how do we help children cultivate this idea?
Do you have an idea?
I think optimism has to be protective. It's hard, you know, young children are very much in the moment, and it's hard to help them see that hard feelings will pass, that tomorrow will be better. I think as much as we can model that for them and teach them that, I think in every situation we have to help children make the most positive attributions possible. We have to help them understand that if they're hurt about something, the other person didn't necessarily mean to do it. You know, we have to help them see that the social world is complex and that you have a lot of choices about how to view things. In terms of their, you know, activities and school and accomplishments and things they may be striving for, I think we need to help them have what Carol Dweck calls an incremental theory of competence, which means that competence isn't something that you have or not. It's not an all or nothing thing. It's something you earn through effort. And if you hit a roadblock, if you hit a snag, if you have a disappointment, that's a signal that you need to try differently. That doesn't mean you have no competence. Mm-hmm. So if we view competence as something you work for bit by bit, if we help children understand it that way, then they are more likely to be able to persevere in the face of negative feedback.
So it helps, I guess, to encourage them just to be flexible in how they're thinking about these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think conveying that, you know, maybe there's another way we can think about this is that's modeling, you know, and maybe this has another meaning, Let's try this one on. Could that be possible? Mm-hmm. I think that's very useful for all of us.
Do children who are told this tend to think, oh, thank goodness, I've been looking for someone to help me? Or do they look at you and say, well, you don't know what you're talking about. This is very serious for me. You know what I mean? There's mm-hmm. there's that sense, you know, I have a seventh grader, and sometimes it's mm-hmm. hard to convince her that we understand what's
yes.
going on.
Well, and I think if a child brings to you a hard event that's happened with peers or something they're really disappointed about, you need to take that time to really listen and empathize. And I think as parents, and certainly as psychologist parents, we're eager to rush in and solve the problem mm-hmm. and start telling them what to do. But I think it's important to just make sure you give them a chance to tell their story, because yeah. sometimes that's what they want to do. And actually, if you're hearing it, you should be lucky. I mean, you're mm-hmm. fortunate if they're telling you. So you want to take that time, but then you want to start helping them think about, okay, what do you want to have happen next? What do you hope will make this better? What could you do? Which is not to blame them, mm-hmm. but to help them feel empowered, to help them feel like they have a chance to control their social world. But I think first, if you listen and you say, oh, I can see why that's so upsetting, I'm so sorry that happened, just a little time on that before you move into problem solving can help.
My guests this hour are Marian Underwood, who is Ashbel Smith Professor at UTD's School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences, and Margaret Owen, who is Director of the Center for Children and Families at UT Dallas. The Center for Children and Families is holding its annual forum this Thursday, September 22nd, focusing on issues of childhood resilience. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send your question via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Margaret Owen is with us today. She's director of the Center for Children and Families at UT Dallas, which is holding its annual forum this Thursday, September 22nd, focusing on childhood resilience. Marian Underwood is here as well. She is Ashbel Smith Professor at UTD's School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences. If you want to talk to us today, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So we've talked a lot about the risks of poverty and abuse. There are also kids from families that are doing okay financially and are not abusive who are really struggling today. Are there different kinds of risks these days that we hadn't identified in the past?
Well, actually, this research, which began coming out about 10 years ago, was pretty surprising because, as you say, we do assume that there are going to be risks of these bad things, but families who have enough money, who are affluent, those kids ought to be okay, right? Mm-hmm. They've got everything. And the surprising findings, much of it coming from our keynote speaker who's coming this week, Dr. Sunya Luthar, said that affluence can be a risk too for children. And her research has found surprising numbers of these children suffering from anxieties, from substance abuse, anxiety and depression in particular of the girls that exceeds national norms, and substance abuse that is equal if not greater than the substance abuse rates among children from very low-income families.
So what's at work there? Is it too much pressure on these kids?
Well, she's also done research probing that, just like, you know, all questions of resilience. We want to know who does well and who's particularly doing bad, because research on risk, research on resilience maybe gives us some good ideas about what we need to be doing. And yes, there is pressure, but what seems to be coming out is sort of a funneling through how do parents handle this? What are the relationships between the child and the parent again? And it's not just pressure, and she's looked at this as well, pressure of too many activities, mm-hmm. you know, too much money and too much to do. It's not just that. It is really more pressure to achieve in the absence of parents really being there and supporting that achievement. You know, not having dinners together, not really showing a commitment to your child and your child's well-being.
So is this the tiger mom phenomenon at work?
Perhaps a little bit. It looks like the affluent parents in Dr. Luthar's studies are a little bit higher on parental criticism and on parental expectations. Mm-hmm. And so when she studies the role of time spent in activities, that predicts no bad outcomes. It's parental criticism and high parental expectations. When she compares affluent families to lower income families, they're similar on a lot of the dimensions that we know matter. Family closeness, simply having dinner together one night a week, where the affluent families look a little different is in parental criticism and high expectations. And if you think about the specific findings, Dr. Luthar studies 6th and 7th graders, and it's in that age group she's finding higher than typical rates of substance abuse in the more affluent kids. And in the affluent group only, the rate of substance abuse is related to anxiety and depression, which suggests that those young people are self-medicating. In the affluent group only, boys' substance use is positively related to their peer popularity, which suggests that in that community context, somehow using substance earlier garners peer support.
That's terrifying.
It is terrifying.
Are there other differences in gender in how boys and girls handle stressful situations?
Well, she is finding that the elevated rates of depression among the children of affluence is particularly in among girls. And anxiety is prevalent among the boys and the girls, but it's the high depressive rates of depressive symptoms that's really alarming for the girls.
And girls in general start to rise in their rates of depression at the start of adolescence. Mm-hmm. In childhood, boys and girls are similar in their rates of depression, but girls' rates start to increase. And there are lots of theories about why that might be. The changes that come along with pubertal development for girls are not necessarily received positively, whereas for boys, it's good to be big and strong and to develop early. For girls, it looks like early development poses risks in just about every domain that you can imagine. So that's part of what might be going on with the girls. Another difference is that in the face of negative affect, when girls are upset, they tend to ruminate more than boys do, which means go over and over the problem, not to solve it, not to fix it, not in any constructive manner.
They're just stuck.
Just dwelling on how mm-hmm. badly they feel. Mm-hmm. That's a persistent gender difference, really, from about early adolescence on up. Girls and women ruminate more than boys and men. And that appears to explain why our episodes of sadness, even depression, are longer lasting.
So I'm guessing as parents, when we walk in the room and say, snap out of it, that's not really that helpful. So what can we do?
Oh, I think another tendency for parents is to say, well, see, I told you so. You should have mm-hmm. done this. You should have done that. Uh-huh. Now, why didn't you do this? And this would have helped. So why didn't you do that? That's not where to focus. I think we need to go back again to what we were talking about earlier. Let's look at this situation maybe in a different way, because we seem to be stuck here. What do you think might be another possibility?
So acknowledge the emotion and then say, where are we going from here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Rachel in Keller. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a senior at UNT in the education program to be an elementary teacher, and I was curious on your thoughts about fostering resilience with children with chronic illnesses.
Well, again, from the research literature, we certainly know that relationships are a key. And the intervention programs that are research-based and really show evidence of working, you know, the evidence-based practices in early intervention are relationship-based. There are a number of these. Alicia Lieberman's work with parent-infant psychotherapy, Webster Stratton's work called The Incredible Years. There are several programs that work to strengthen the relationships. Now that sounds pretty vague. Working on helping parents to read their signals in their child, recognizing what those signals mean, reflecting on that, thinking about what would be helpful. Parents often tend to just do, command, direct. And some of these programs are really good at saying we need to do some observing work. We need to describe what we see. Describe your child's behavior and see what kind of a different perspective that might give.
Chronic illness seems like such an interesting case because, you know, children from a very young age may in fact be aware that this problem isn't going away, as opposed to even a conflict at school or things like that. Do children sort of carry that weight with them, the idea that they may be sick for a very long time?
I think they do, and it, of course, depends on the condition. But I think with so many chronic illnesses, there are things that the child can do and that the family can help the child do for there to be better income. So, mm-hmm. for example, for adolescents with type 1 diabetes, there are a lot of things that parents can do to help young people learn to manage their own disease, to empower that person, to make the best choices, and to feel like I can have an influence on how my life unfolds. Yes, I have this condition, but I can still do things to help myself, to help things be better.
And that sense that they have power over what's happening to them must be really amazing, in that it's not like you have to wait around for someone to come and fix this problem for you. It's saying, I have confidence in you that you can do some of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a term that we call self-reliance, which I like a lot. And we can actually observe differences in children in their school classrooms. And the child who is self-reliant has certainly skills of self-control, emotion control. They're not grabbed by every fun thing that's happening by their peers around them. Mm-hmm. They know they have a task to do. They stay focused on that. They direct their attention appropriately. But here's the part I really like, too. If they need some help, they know how to ask the teacher for help. Hmm. They know how to maybe get some of the assistance from their peers who might understand that problem a little better than they do. Those are what we call self-reliant children. And children who increase in self-reliance from first grade to third grade are the children who are really the better achieving children in third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade.
And that takes some confidence, too, I guess, to reach out and ask for help as opposed to just trying to keep that all concealed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Anne on the line in Grapevine. Hello, Anne.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. And I have a question. I'm the mother of a 7-year-old boy, and he really struggles with making and keeping, you know, your most basic schoolmate, playmate type friends, and I struggle in that myself. I'm more social with my family than I am with, you know, any kind of, you know, outside friendships other than work. So when he does come to me and does open up for help, I'm almost at a loss for how to encourage him to continue to try and how to be outgoing and assertive and fun and sharing. And, you know, I know what to say to him, but I really struggle with giving him the ways to use those tools.
Well, thanks for your call. Any ideas for Anne, what she might tell her son?
You know, it depends so much on the specific situations he finds challenging. But I think in general, we have to remember that not all children have, you know, 30 best friends. I think some of us have this kind of movie image of in our minds that, you know, everybody has lots of social opportunities. I think it's important to realize that lots of children, you know, are a little reluctant or don't have all the opportunities they wish they did. A simple skill that you can work on teaching your child is how to join a group, you know, on a playground. And some of what we think is effective for helping join groups isn't really, according to research. Hmm. Research by Martha Patalis and others shows that if a child wants to join a group at play, what's most effective is if they watch for a minute, but not long enough to be hovering, watch a little bit, and then just start joining in the activity. Not barging in and trying to commandeer the situation or to dictate the way the game will go, not hanging on the fringes and doing nothing and hovering, but just watching for a minute, understanding what people are doing, and joining in. That's the simple kind of thing that we can coach our children on that might make a big difference. We have to help them know it doesn't always go perfectly. You may do that and it may not work out, but they have to keep trying. I think it's protective, too, for children to have lots of social opportunities outside of school. In elementary school, the classroom social pool is so small that a child may not find a compatible friend. But if they have an activity they like, a club they want to join, that's a way that they would naturally come in contact with people with similar interests. And if you have relationships with neighbors or church friends or soccer friends, it's easier to take it when school doesn't go so well. And I can, you know, it's not easy for all mothers to set up lots of play dates and lots of social opportunities. Those of us who work, that's not a straightforward matter. Having children in activities can be a natural way for them to have time with peers that we don't always have to arrange and to give them chances to meet compatible friends.
Are there things we can do for, say, the kids down the block, assuming that we don't suspect any abuse whatsoever, but we think things aren't going well for mom and dad? Can we intervene in a way as sort of caring strangers who may not be that child's best friend, but want to see them do all right?
Well, it's hard to know how to start, but you, excuse me, you are another adult that's observing this child that hopefully, I mean, that's how you know. You've seen some things occur. You've seen this child. This child may be, hopefully, a friend of your child's. And welcoming mm-hmm. them into your home, sharing a meal with your family, mm-hmm. Encouraging them, you know, having another good relationship with an adult who is caring, who shows that they care, is really important for the child.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Ron in Plano. Hello, Ron.
Hi, Chris. I'm an educational therapeutic consultant, and I work on referrals from psychologists who have come to the conclusion that usually there's an adolescent child, their patient needs a residential therapeutic placement. And I wondered if your guests have used or work with educational consultants and what their opinion is of wilderness programs, therapeutic boarding schools, residential treatment centers, and not boot camps and not 90-day programs. These are programs that last a year or more and for $6,000 to $12,000 a month.
I think sometimes when a child is struggling with behavior problems and failing in school and disappointing everyone around them, something just needs to change. You know, there are times when a child needs to be in a different environment. I think that can be accomplished in a lot of ways. I don't see a lot of research evidence that wilderness-type programs are highly effective or even residential programs, but they could be for individuals. I think sometimes if a child is just in a downward spiral, it's like they're a system and something needs to change. And sometimes the smallest thing can make a difference. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I've worked with children with behavior problems. And so often the pressure can be alleviated by a short visit with grandparents, just a short time outside the home. And mm-hmm. I know that sounds naive, and you are probably dealing with much more serious situations. But to me, residential treatment is a very serious step because it removes that child from the parents. It loses the opportunity to work on repairing that relationship. It takes that child to a different environment. Yes, that does interrupt whatever the problems are. It takes them away from a deviant peer group. It takes them away from, you know, a teacher who may have given up on them, but it also takes them away from their families. I think the best residential programs are brief, include the parents, include a lot of interaction with the parents to try to help repair that connection.
On the other side of the coin, talk about helicopter parenting. Are we teaching kids that they are helpless by making, you know, overseeing every single thing they do?
I think we might be. Mm-hmm. I think we might be. And this is why we don't want to think of all of the ways that we can direct our child. There are different forms of parenting, and being overly directive can get easily into the realm of being intrusive. And sometimes it can also change into negative and hostile parenting mm-hmm. as well, because when you don't see what you like and you want to change that,
Say it louder and more times.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
My guests this hour are Marian Underwood, who is director of the Center for Children and Families at UT Dallas, and Margaret Owen, and Marian Underwood, who is Ashbel Smith Professor at UTD's School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences. They are both participants in the Center for Children and Families annual forum this coming Thursday, September 22nd, which will focus on issues of childhood resilience. We will resume our conversation in a moment and invite you to join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're here this hour with Margaret Owen, who is director of the Center for Children and Families at UT Dallas, and Marian Underwood, Ashbel Smith Professor at UTD's School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences. The Center for Children and Families holds its annual forum on this Thursday, September 22nd, focusing on childhood resilience. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. If we look at our kids and see that they cope well or not so well with small irritations and problems, what does that tell us about how they might cope with much more serious issues?
I hope it's a very good sign. Mm-hmm. I hope it's a very good sign. I think we build our abilities to cope with larger catastrophes. And you build confidence in your ability by having those experiences. Of course, it's easier to cope with the small things, mm-hmm. but to see those as small but important achievements, I think is an important thing. And I think acknowledging that for your child, too, that's the kind of praise for your child that I think we're talking about, that's really important. Not just good boy, good girl, mm-hmm. but look how you did that.
specific to the task.
Yes, absolutely mm-hmm. specific. And I bet that felt good.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Jesse in Terrell. Hello, Jesse.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have one question and one observation. My question is whether or not there was any filter on the studies that are being referenced regarding kids who have a genetic predisposition to anxiety and depression. In other words, you know, a family history of that those sort of disorders. My second observation is, or my second thing that I want to say is, I once heard or read, I'm not sure which, that one of the best things you could do for your kids was to allow them to make mistakes and not overreact and let them work out on their own how to resolve that issue or how to do it differently the next time. That I thought that sounded smart, and I did it with my kids, and I think it's one of the single most useful things I ever utilized. They're all three of my kids are critical observers of their environment and make decisions, manage the mistakes they make, and make thoughtful decisions. Well, I just wanted to toss that out there. Yeah.
Jesse, thank you so much for your call.
I think it's a great observation as well, and sounds perfect. Let me go back to her first question, though, about whether the participants in these studies that we're talking about, whether there was knowledge of, I believe she said, their genetic predispositions to depression or anxiety. Not that I'm aware of. This is research that sampled pretty large numbers of children and their families, and it's not just one study either. Dr. Luthar is now following a large sample of, I think it's about, well, it's large for developmental psychology, about 350, 360 children, as Marion said, starting in sixth grade and following them into adulthood. I do not believe that they were pre-selected. They were selected primarily in terms of the communities that they were growing up in.
When you say large for developmental psychology, mm-hmm. that's because, I'm imagining it's a much more complex and time-consuming process to chart and categorize all the things you're studying as opposed to a blood pressure number on a computer that you can just check in with every month or two.
That's right. That's right. And you know, when we're studying families, we're developing relationships with those families, mm-hmm. too, because we want them to care about and know how much we appreciate their participation in our studies. And we hope we're able to find them the next time around, because I think we get the richest data from being able to follow children and their development over time, not just to look at a group of third graders and fifth graders and eighth graders mm-hmm. and 12th graders, all from, different perhaps family backgrounds, different developmental histories, but to follow families that we can learn about over time, see the different things that they experience, the moves the family makes, the changes in the family income, the relationships that the children are developing, and also do some observations of those relationships. And that's why it's very intense work, developmental research, but very rewarding.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Allison in Richardson. Hello, Allison.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Chris.
Sure.
You were describing the self-reliant child. It was everything that I want for my daughter, and I loved hearing that, and I'm just struggling with how to encourage that in someone who seems to really not have any interest in it whatsoever. Last night's homework, the difference in lose with one O and loose with two O's, she wanted me to answer it. I say grab the dictionary, and the anger that comes back, and I just, is this just par for the course? And I mean, how do you step back and let them find the answers if they really have no interest in finding the answers?
I'm guessing Allison is not alone in this sort of issue.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's hard to try to address the specific instilling how do you look up the difference between how you spell it this way and you spell it that way, that's kind of tough for me. But I think that you have to find other small ways where you can point out how your child solved a particular problem. I think, again, observing and describing is very helpful, and supporting and appreciating those skills. And I bet there are other situations and other times, and not when you're struggling with that particular homework issue, where you can see this skill that you're hoping to nurture and help to encourage it.
How important are chores and responsibilities within the family?
I think they're very important. I think there needs to be a sense that every member of the family contributes something. I'm a fan of having children have some money to learn how to manage money, but I actually don't link it to chores. Chores are what we do because we're members of a family, mm-hmm. we're members of a household, and we want to help each other. I think those can be chances to teach self-reliance. And the hard thing about promoting self-reliance is that, you know, it's a very developmental process. The things that children do in response to our attempts to help, the homework struggles, those are both par for the course and extremely frustrating. It doesn't, just because they're typical doesn't mean it's not maddening. I think we have to try our very best to stay calm, as hard as it is, our very best to just give them suggestions. The way in which we need to do that changes with development. I was with some very wise parents of now grown children the other night, and they were describing when their three daughters first learned to drive, and all of them had fender benders mm-hmm. in those first months. And they said that, you know, they were just crushed and so devastated, the girls were, but that the parents guided them in calling the insurance company themselves, in taking all of the steps needed when you have an automobile accident to get the car repaired. And I thought that was such a wonderful example, not of being punitive, but of teaching self-reliance, but being right behind them, guiding them. A 15-year-old wouldn't know how to approach an insurance company, but the parent was coaching them. So we have to be very calm coaches.
Well, it seems like it's a better lesson to deal with bureaucratic red tape anyway than to be grounded for 2 weeks after wrecking the car.
Yes.
You'll remember that much longer. Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Sean on the line in Dallas. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Chris. Hi, everyone on the panel. My question is, please, I have a 10-year-old fifth grader who is, as they say, talented. He's in the gifted and talented program. And I'm having troubles with him actually just getting motivated in doing the work. He can do the work, but he just is not motivated. Is there any suggestions for a parent with these situations?
Oh, it's hard to know. Mm-hmm. It's hard to know. Can I ask what else motivates him? Are there other things that you see him enjoying?
Toys, acting, very dramatic, very charismatic, can be funny. But when it comes to the work, and there's
He's got passion, just not for schoolwork.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, it's fantastic that he has that passion. That's wonderful. I think one's very much. It sounds like one's much more appealing to him than the other, and it may be hard to link these. But there's work involved in both. The schoolwork's not something that pulls him, attracts him right now. Maybe you need to help find some ways of linking it. I don't know quite what to say here, but it's fantastic that he has a love of some of his activities, and I think reflecting on that and how sometimes it's hard to do things we don't want to do, but there's reward in that as well.
We have an email here from Jackie who writes, "The loss of a parent can really rock a child's confidence. In addition to professional help, what can the surviving parent do to help their child reestablish the resilience they had been building?"
It's a simple thing, but I think routines matter enormously to children. I think they need to understand that although there's been this major change in their world, some things will continue, mm-hmm. that the remaining parent will be there, that someone will still tuck them into bed and, you know, read them stories sometimes or whatever the child likes to do. I think they need to understand that they'll still be a family, even though it won't be the same as it was before, that there will be a family and there will be a household and there will be things to look forward to. So I think as much as possible, sticking to routines, trying to keep things as much the same as possible. It's very hard. It's hard on the remaining parent. I think that's important that, you know, the remaining parent do everything she can to take care of herself. Dr. Luther has a whole line of research on mothers as people and how if we're depleted, we're not able to do for our children. But that's easier said than done. If you're a single parent, it's very hard to meet just your child's needs, never mind yours too.
When you say routines, does that include things like expectations that you will continue taking out the trash and doing those kinds of things? I see you both nodding your heads.
Yep. Yes. Absolutely. Yes.
I think as many things that stay the same provide great comfort for children. Children crave structure, even if they resist it sometimes. Mm-hmm. And they take a lot of comfort in things being the same.
Yeah. It's funny because it's counterintuitive. You sort of think, let's suspend everything and just mm-hmm. kind of be kind, but that may not ultimately serve them well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. I think they'll have something to hold on to when they know some of their life does remain the same. It was a major change, and this is going to be hard. But a lot of things are still there for me.
Are certain cultures more resilient than others?
Not that I know of.
Mm-hmm. The things that foster resilience might mm-hmm. be a little bit different culture to culture because of different values. Norms and different values. But I don't think there are any cultural or ethnic differences in resilience per se. It's a phenomenon we see all around the world.
What are we learning about predicting people who might lack resilience skills, so that we can help them before exposing them to something we know will be stressful? And I'm thinking of the research that's being done by the U.S. military right now to make sure that soldiers are prepared and service people in all the services are prepared for what they might face overseas.
Oh, well, gosh, that's a big one.
Are there yes. a set of questions you can ask to sort of tell how someone's doing with regard to resilience?
Well, I think are there important relationships in your life?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love the quote. It comes from developmental psychology, but it's from the National Scientific Council for the Developing Child, that relationships are the active ingredient mm-hmm. in healthy human development. And I think that there's going to be a loss of relationships when soldiers are shipped overseas.
Yeah.
There's going to be a loss of the immediate relationship here and now, the one to touch. But it's amazing what we have now with, Skyping and cell phone coverage and abilities to stay connected. And I think that's a great source of resilience.
I think also being willing to talk about how you're feeling and reach out and make those relationships mm-hmm. where you are makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a lot of research on post-traumatic stress that, prior distress predicts having a worse response in the face of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
There's a trait called anxiety sensitivity, being very, very concerned about bodily sensations and getting into catastrophizing thinking. When you start to feel yourself becoming aroused, that actually predicts who develops panic disorder in the face of military combat. And if we could intervene to reduce that.
Sorry, jump in here. We've been speaking this hour with Marian Underwood and Margaret Owen, both of UTD. The UTD Center for Children and Families holds its annual forum on this Thursday. Thank you both so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks
Chris.
Having us.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.